All right, if you have your Bibles, turn to Daniel chapter 2. And hopefully everybody got a handout on the way in. My printer ran out of black ink, and so I only got 15 printed. That should be enough for everybody. But if you missed one, maybe you can convince one of the couples to share. Did anybody not get one? All right, everybody's got one. Good. All right, Daniel chapter 3. We're in Daniel chapter 3, and if you'll recall last week, we finished up Daniel chapter 2, and in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has this really odd dream, and in his dream, he sees this statue, and the composition of the statue is these different materials, and it starts with gold, and then silver, bronze, iron, and then clay mixed with iron, or iron mixed with clay. And he's really, you know, he doesn't understand what this dream means. And so Daniel, with the Lord's help, reveals to him the interpretation of the dream. And the meaning of the dream is that the statue represents all the different empires of the world. You know, and gold is Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar as its king. He is to be the greatest king of the greatest earthly empire, and he's the head of gold. All right, and then it goes to silver, which is the Medo-Persians, bronze, which is Greece, iron, which is Rome, and then the feet and the toes of clay mixed with iron is a revived Roman Empire that's going to take place in the end times. And I was actually having a really interesting conversation with a friend this week, and he's not really current on his eschatology, as he would say, and usually he brings up these little niche things for us to talk about, and it's usually something that I'm not like super studied up on because it's kind of some niche thing that like doesn't really pertain to me. But usually he's like, hoo-ah, you know, flexing on me because I've thought about this thing. But this week the roles were reversed because I was asking him all these questions about eschatology because he takes a metaphoric interpretation to the book of Revelations. I was like, okay, well then what do you think this means? Well, what do you think this means? What do you think this means? Oh, I don't know. I know it's a metaphor. And I was like, well, metaphor for what? And he didn't know. So anyways, that was an interesting conversation. But I actually brought this up and I was like, well, if you take a metaphorical approach, then how does that match up with Nebuchadnezzar's dream? You know, four literal kingdoms and then a metaphoric one. Like, anyway, so it was an interesting conversation. But anyways, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and Daniel, with the Lord's help, is able to interpret this dream. And sort of the conclusion for Nebuchadnezzar is that he is the head of gold, right? He is to be the greatest earthly king of the greatest earthly kingdom, save Jesus and the kingdom of heaven. But he is to be the greatest king of the greatest empire to rule the world, and he walks away from that conversation with an inflated ego. You know, his head swells a couple of hat sizes, and he completely misinterprets what Daniel was referring to there. And so we get to Daniel 3, verse 1, and it says, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, that's 90 feet, 60 feet, right? No, 60 would be 60. Yeah, 90 feet. And the breadth thereof, 6 cubits. That would be 9 feet. No, that would be 12. That would be 18 feet. Excuse me. I can do math, I promise. And he set it in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, you can't help but think that this is Nebuchadnezzar's response to the news of chapter 2, right? Daniel has informed Nebuchadnezzar that he will be the greatest king of the grandest empire, and this expands his head a few hat sizes. And so we see reference as well here to the plain of Dura. And I wasn't able to find too much on this area, but I did learn that Dura was situated at the top of a cliff that overlooked the Euphrates River some 300 feet down. And of course, we know that the Euphrates River was heavily utilized with the trade routes. And so essentially, he takes this massive statue of himself and he puts it in the middle of this plain that is visible from a highly trafficked river, and so you'd be able to see this thing from miles around. And so he takes this statue and he situates it in a very public, prominent, and central location, right? And then we read in verse 2, then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Verse 3, then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the province were gathered together under the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And so Nebuchadnezzar calls for all these public figures, right? All these high-ranking officials, town leaders, all that kind of stuff, to come for the dedication of this statue, and so they all come. And we're going to see in just a minute that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are among these officials. But for some reason, it does not seem that Daniel is there. And so Daniel is not a prominent figure in this passage. Maybe he's away on king's business. You know, we know from the end of chapter 2 that he sets up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as governors in the province. It says, but Daniel sat in the court of the king. And so maybe Daniel's away on king's business. You know, maybe he's at home with the flu. But for whatever reason, he doesn't seem to be there. But nevertheless, the king calls all these officials, and they all come. Then we see in verses 4 and 5, he says, then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O people, nation, and languages, that at the time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. And so this herald cries out and he says, okay, guys, when you hear the sound of all these different musical instruments, it is required of you that you bow down and worship this statue of Nebuchadnezzar, this gold statue, like you would bow down and worship a god. And now we have to remember that culturally, in this culture, the king was viewed as being an extension of the gods. And so it would not have seemed strange or overly egotistical of a king, any king, to do something like this, right? To set up an image of himself and to say, you have to worship it, right? And in fact, when we get to Revelation, we're going to see that the Antichrist is going to do something very similar to that. He's going to set up an image of himself, and he's going to require that everybody worship it. And so this is not an unusual thing. And so just kind of keep that in mind, because it's going to come up a few more times in the next couple chapters. And so the king views himself as having God status in the mind of Babylon. And so the herald says, when you hear the music, you got to bow down, you got to worship. But then he continues in verse 6 and says, and whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And so we need to be careful not to go too far with the symbolism here. We need to be careful not to say that the furnace was supposed to be a representation of some sort of pagan hell to those who fail to please the gods. But there could be some of that in this case. But either way, what the herald is saying is that there are some serious consequences to consider for those who fail to obey the king's edicts. And just by way of application here, before we go too much further, you know, how many of us have ever experienced a situation where someone tells us to do something that we know we're not supposed to do? Or alternatively, someone tells us not to do something that we know we're supposed to be doing? You know, and whether there are consequences for that or whether there's not consequences for that, it's really a frustrating circumstance, isn't it? Because you kind of find yourself in a pickle, right? Like, hey, here's what I know is supposed to be happening, and you're telling me to do something that's contrary, and it kind of feels like no matter what I do, I lose, right? You guys ever felt that way? You know, it's like no matter what I do, you know, I'm going to lose. And so if nothing else, it puts us in this really difficult, awkward position sometimes. And we feel the pressure to either do or not do whatever it is that we're being told to do or not do. One example of this is, I grew up in Japan, y'all know that, and I went to public school in Japan for 3 years, kindergarten, first and second grade. And once you get to the higher levels, it isn't this way. But on the lower, you know, lower elementary, you know, kindergarten, that sort of stuff, a lot of times for PE class, you learn how to swim. Now, I never learned how to swim, which is weird because I was part of that class, but I never learned how to swim, probably just didn't pay attention. But for PE class, you would do swimming and you do swimming lessons. Well, as you can imagine, it can be difficult to facilitate the transition from the classroom to the swimming pool and back. But in Japan, for the lower classes, everyone would just change in the same room. So, you know, everyone would have their bag and everyone would just change into their swimsuit. And when they would come back, everyone would change back. Just everybody in that same room. Well, my parents didn't like that, of course. And so my parents told my teacher, you know, we don't want our son to be changing in the same room as girls. And, you know, we don't want our son in the same room while girls are changing. And so when it comes time to transition to the pool, we want our son to go to the bathroom, to change in the bathroom and to wait until everyone's changed. And then, you know, same thing for going back. Well, the teacher didn't understand, like, what's the big deal, right? And the administration didn't understand, what's the big deal? And so I found myself as a first and second grader. I don't really remember that much in kindergarten, but I remember as a first and second grader, I had to take the initiative to say, hey, I need to leave and go to the bathroom for this. And that was really hard for me. You know, I'm a first grader, right? Or a second grader. That was really hard for me. And a lot of times, and I remember this, a lot of the kids would laugh and be like, that stupid gaijin. Gaijin is the word for foreigner. Gaikoku is foreign country and jin is person. So literally foreign country person. And they say, that stupid gaijin, he has to go leave and change somewhere else, you know. And they would tease me about that, and I remember that. And that really put me in an awkward position, and I kind of felt like no matter what I do, I lose. If I leave, I get laughed at. If I stay and my parents find out, I get yelled at. So that really put me in a really awkward situation. And sometimes as believers, we find ourselves in those situations where we feel like no matter what we do, we lose. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they find themselves in this kind of a situation where kind of no matter what they do, they lose, right? If we fall down and worship, we will be dishonoring our God. If we don't fall down and worship, there's this fiery furnace waiting for us. And so the herald relays the command, and in verse 7, we read this. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And so the music plays, everybody bows down and worships, everyone except for three people. And we read about that in verses 8 and 9. It says, wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. And so after the first round of worship, these Chaldeans, and remember who they are, they're these supernatural, you know, they would claim supernatural enlightenment through science and religion and divination. We learned in the last chapter that essentially what they do is they just kiss up to the king and try to make nice with him to get position and prestige and profit. And so they come. And, of course, they're mad at these guys because, you know, Daniel showed them up in the last chapter. And so they come to the king and they snitch. It says they came near and they accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Now, remember that phrase, O king, live forever. It's just kind of this obligatory greeting that was designed to gain favor. But in this case, it may also be serving to reinforce the worship that they've just given to the king. Hey, king, live forever, right? We're willing to worship you. We're willing to feed your fantasy that you have this God status as the king of Babylon. And so they come to the king, they say, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree. Now, it's not like he forgot, but they're reminding him of all the little details, right? Have you guys noticed that? That when, people who seem like they're kind of fuzzy on the details, when it benefits them, they can be pretty good on the details, right? And these guys, they're reminding the king of all the little minutiae of what he said because they're about to make their case. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And so they repeat to the king what he's commanded, and they make sure that they include the punishment that was attached to a failure to comply. Hey, king, you said we had to do this, and king, just in case you forgot, I want to remind you of what you said. You said that if anybody doesn't worship, you were going to throw them in the burning fiery furnace. Don't forget that, king. You said you were going to throw them in the burning fiery furnace. All right, and so... So they come to the king and they make this accusation. And just keep in mind that this is the same group of people that are going to bring the same accusation about the same type of order to a different king this time or next time regarding Daniel. And they're going to try to have him thrown into something lethal as well. And you guys know that story. And so that's coming. But they remind the king of his edict. They remind the king of his punishment. It says there, and then they said in verse 12, there are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Hey, king, there's these three guys, and you set these three guys up to help you rule over the affairs of Babylon, but they haven't regarded you. Right? They don't serve your gods. They don't worship the image that you set up. And based on what we know of Babylonian culture, and based on what we see in Daniel 2, here in Daniel 3, and then again in Daniel 6, I think it's fair to say that this exchange is partially motivated by jealousy. Right? They're angry about what happened in Daniel chapter 2. You know, they're still trying to leverage the king to get what they want from him, their power, their prestige, and their profit. And so a lot of this is motivated by jealousy. They're trying to build themselves up in the eyes of the king. They're trying to put down Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so it almost comes across, I say all that to say, it almost comes across as kind of this childish sibling rivalry, right? Hey, king, we bow down. Oh, king, live forever. But those guys that you set up, they disregard you. They don't worship you. They don't value you like we value you. And so they come and they say all this to the king, and then we see his response in verse 13. It says, then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. And so Nebuchadnezzar's really angry. He calls for the men to be brought. And the men are brought. Then in verse 14, it says, Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? And so he questions them about the events that have taken place. And that could very well be because he still doesn't trust anything that the magic council, I call them, it could very well be that he doesn't really trust anything that they have to say. And so he's just verifying their story. We don't really know that for sure, but that's a good guess there. And he says, is it true that you haven't worshipped my God, that you haven't worshipped the image that I set up? He says in verse 15, now if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. Hey, listen, I'm going to give you all another chance here. All right, when, you know, maybe when my dad tells this story, how he says, you know, maybe you guys didn't understand what you were supposed to do, right? Maybe you guys were running a little bit late and you didn't hear the instructions, right? Maybe, you know, maybe seeing everybody else bow down, maybe you got a little confused by that or whatever. So just here's what you do. When you hear the music, when you're ready, bow down and worship. You do that, great. He says, but if you worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. He says, and who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? He says, you know, maybe you didn't understand, whatever. If you're ready, when you hear the music, bow down. He says, but if you don't bow down, there are going to be consequences. And he says, I am the ultimate authority in your life, and so my word is final. He's really taking a position, or at least he's trying to take a position of authority over them, and it almost feels parental, almost a little bit. But he makes a couple of mistakes, and the main mistake that he makes is in assuming that he's ultimately in charge of this situation, and he's ultimately in control of how it plays out. He believes himself to be God here, and he believes that no lesser God to him or no inferior God to him was going to be able to thwart his authority. And you may say, well, how do you know that that's what he's saying? It's in that last phrase. He says, and who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hand? See, he recognizes anybody's refusal to bow down would be a refusal to bow down in respect to some other God. Like if I'm Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or if I'm even Benj Melton and I'm there, I'm not going to be like, I'm not going to bow down because I just don't feel like it. Like, nobody's going to say that. No one's going to say, hey, I'm going to risk my life simply because I'm too lazy or I'm too stubborn to bow down to the king. No. Anyone who would, and the king recognizes this, anyone who would refuse to bow down to his image would be doing so in respect to another God. And so what Nebuchadnezzar is saying is, I'm better than your God. I'm stronger than your God. Your God has no power over me. My rule is absolute. I'm the head of gold, right? I'm the greatest king of the grandest empire. Like, I'm all that in a bag of chips. And so you bow down and worship me because I'm all that, and there is not a God out there who has authority, supreme authority over me. And so this is what he's saying. You don't want to bow down and respect some other God, but what power does that God have to deliver you from my hand? And of course, if you know anything about this story, you know that things do not play out the way that Nebuchadnezzar expects them to. But all the same, he does give this authoritarian command to worship his idol. Then we see in verse 16, we see the response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It says, then these three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. They respond in answer to his somewhat rhetorical question about what God there is that could deliver them from his hand. And the word careful here really just kind of has the idea of necessity. Hey, we don't really feel like we don't really feel like we have to give you an answer here. We don't necessarily feel like we owe you one. And it's almost as if they're saying, look, King, we're not afraid of you. We're not afraid to stand up and to speak up for what we believe. Right? That word careful could also have the idea of hesitance. Hey, we're not afraid to speak up and to answer your accusation that you are, or not really an accusation, but your claim that you are the supreme authority here. And so they're really just expressing that they're not afraid of this threat. And why are they not afraid of his threat? Because they recognize that he's not in charge here. He thinks he's in charge here, but he's not. They recognize that their God is supremely in control of this situation. And when he says, what God is there that can deliver you out of my hands? The answer is, the God can deliver you out of my hand, me out of your hand. And so they said, we're not careful to answer you in this matter, but rather verse 17, it says, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. You know, just kind of as a side note, don't forget in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel had told Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold because God has made it that way. See, Daniel recognized that Nebuchadnezzar was who he was because God made him that way. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego recognized that Nebuchadnezzar is who he is because God made him that way. And eventually, that's coming. Eventually, Nebuchadnezzar is going to recognize that he is who he is because God made him that way. But he's not there yet. And so they said, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. They said, look, king, if you want to throw us in the fire, have at it. Our God has the ability to deliver us from the fire, and one way or the other, he will deliver us from your hand. He says in verse 18, but if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. He says, look, our God has the ability to deliver us from your hand. But even if he lets you kill us, that doesn't change our decision. Right? If God chooses not to deliver us from the fire and we die, that's fine, because either way, we will not worship your gods. We will not worship your idol. And that's the end of the story. Now, it's not the end of this story, but as far as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are concerned, the discussion is closed. Look, king, you want us to do something that we're not supposed to do, we won't do it. And if that means consequences, we will embrace the consequences. But we're still going to do what's right. And I remember Pastor Jim was telling me a story about one of their sons. Was it fighting? He got in trouble in school for standing up and defending someone. And Pastor Jim said, look, you did the right thing, but there's consequences for fighting. And so even though you did the right thing, you're still going to have to deal with the consequences. And that's okay, right? You know, sometimes there's consequences for doing what's right, and that's okay. Because God is in control, and that's what matters the most. And so I just want to draw a couple of takeaways here from this first half of Daniel 3, and then we'll look at the rest of the story next week. I got to keep you coming back for more. And so we'll finish this account next week, because it's really just too much to really talk through in 1 week. But like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and I switched up the order a little bit just because it looks nicer as Sam. So if I accidentally say like Sam, just know that I'm referring to Shadrach, Abednego, and Meshach. But like these three, we need to understand that sometimes the world will threaten us to get us to conform to their standard, but we must not give in to the pressure. You know, Christians in our world today often get accused of hate speech. They get shunned and boycotted. They get called bigots. They get called ignorant and uneducated. They get mocked. They get laughed at. And all of it is because they don't conform to the world's expectations and ideals. You know, the world wants us to live by their ideals. They want us to agree with the choices they're making. They want us to participate with them in the self-fulfilling endeavors that they devote their lives to. And just like this situation here, there's going to be times when the world is going to try to threaten us and bully us into conformity, but we can't give in to the pressure. James 1:12, we looked at this on a Sunday morning, oh, probably about a month or two back, no more than that, probably about 8 weeks ago. It says, blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. You know, temptation's going to come. God is not a source of it. We know that. That's verse 13. But when temptation comes, if we, with the Lord's help, endure that temptation, successfully navigate that with his help without giving in to that temptation, he says there is a crown of life right? There are tangible rewards and benefits to not giving in to the pressure of the world. Psalm 118, verse 6, it says, "The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do unto me?" You know, David recognized that God is ultimately in control. And if God's on my side, or rather, if I'm on God's side, there's nothing to worry about. There's no fear, right? He says that perfect love casts out fear, right? And so if the Lord is on my side, then I need to follow His plan, not give in to the pressure. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man." There's nothing that any of us endure, no pressure, no temptation, no hardship. There's nothing that any of us go through that somebody else hasn't gone through. He says, but God is faithful. And that's really the kernel there. That's really the hinging point there. God is faithful. And because God is faithful, He will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able. God will never put you in a situation where you're forced to sin. Why? Because He will, with the temptation, make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Now, the question is, what is that way of escape? It's Him, right? God will never force you to sin, but with His help, you can always say no to sin. And so we need to understand that the world sometimes threatens us to get us to conform to their standard, but we must not give in to the pressure. The second thing that we need to realize is that the world will tell you that their approval is all that matters, but we must seek the approval of God. You know, Nebuchadnezzar told Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that worshiping his idol was more important than obedience to their God. He told them that his favor was worth more than God's favor. And the world would have us believe that this life is all about gaining that celebrity status. It's all about being an influencer. It's all about getting those views, those likes, those subscriptions, right? The world would have you believe that acceptance and relevance in this life is more important than obedience, and that popularity trumps principle. You know, there's a lot of people on the internet that will compromise their principles for the sake of popularity. You know, I was talking this morning about the pornography industry in America, and there's a website out there, and I can't remember what the statistic is, but I mean there are people out there, I mean, selling their bodies on the internet for a couple of bucks, and it's insane. And the statistic was something about like, only like 1% or 2% of the girls who utilize this website to sell their bodies for money, only like 1% or 2% of them actually generate enough revenue to live off of. So most of them are selling their bodies for a cup of coffee, you know, and it's insane. It's insane. But the world would have us believe that popularity trumps principle. But that is not the case. Psalm 118, verse 8, just two verses later, it says, "It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man." Acts 5, this is when Peter and the other disciples were beaten and told that they weren't allowed to preach. They go right back out and they start doing it again. And so the magistrate hauls them back in and he says, "Did we not straitly command you that you should not teach in this name? And behold, ye have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us," talking about the crucifixion of Christ. "Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than man." You know, Nebuchadnezzar said there are the benefits to bowing down to my idol outweigh the consequences of violating your God. And when the world tells us that, we need to say no. That is not true. Right, principle always trumps popularity, and obedience always trumps an easy lifestyle. Romans 8:31 says, "What shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us?" And so we need to understand that the world will threaten us to get us to conform to their standard, but we must not give in to the pressure. We need to understand that the world will tell us that their approval is all that matters, but we must seek the approval of God alone. And lastly, we need to understand that we can stand without anxiety because God is in control and he is bigger than the fire. And next week, we're going to see that God is indeed bigger than the fire. But, you know, because of what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew firsthand about their God, they were able to stand unafraid of the king. They were unafraid of his commands, and they were unafraid of his fire. You know, they were able to stand before him, face possible death, and not waver or bow because they knew that he was bigger and that nothing would happen to them outside of his allowance. And in the same manner, as believers, we can stand boldly in the face of wrongful accusations and mockery. We can resist the pull to give in and conform to the world. We don't have to be afraid of what our devotion to God might cost us because he is in control of all things and nothing will happen to us outside of his allowance. Romans 8:28 says, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them who are the called according to his purpose. He doesn't say we know that all things work out to be easy and comfortable and free of hardship. He doesn't say that. He says all things work together for good. And that's spiritual good, right? God will utilize all the circumstances of our life for our spiritual benefit as long as we are devoted to him. He says in 1 John 4, ye are of God, little children, and have overcome them because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. And lastly, we read in Matthew 10:28, fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul. Rather fear, or in this case, reverence him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And so these are a couple of lessons, a couple of takeaways from this first half of Daniel chapter 3, and we will pick up here next week.